Welcome to the next installment of The Green Book by Mr. Gaddafi, the late Gaddafi. I'm your host, Hassan Labduni. And what we're going to do today is finish up part one with chapter 10, The Press. And then we're going to go into part two, The Solution of the Economic Problem, Socialism, with chapters 11, The Economic Basis of the Third Universal Theory, and chapter 12, Need. So, starting off with chapter 10, The Press. The Press. An individual has the right to express himself or herself even if he or she behaves irrationally to demonstrate his or her insanity. Corporate bodies, too, have the right to express their corporate identity. The former represent only themselves, and the latter represent those who share their corporate identity. Since society consists of private individuals and corporate bodies, the expression, for example, by an individual of his or her insanity does not mean that the other members of society are insane. Such expression reflects only in the individual's character. Likewise, corporate expression reflects only the interest or view of those making up the corporate body. For instance, a tobacco company, despite the fact that what it produces is harmful to health, expresses the interest of those who make up the company. The press is a means of expression for society. It is not a means of expression for private individuals or corporate bodies. Therefore, logically and democratically, it should not belong to either one of them. A newspaper owned by an individual is his or her own and expresses only his or her point of view. Any claim that a newspaper represents public opinion is groundless because it actually expresses the viewpoint of that private individual. Democratically, private individuals should not be permitted to own any public means of publication or information. However, they have the right to express themselves by any means, even irrationally, to prove their insanity. Any journal issued by a professional sector, for example, is only a means of expression of that particular social group. It presents their own points of view and not that of the general public. This applies to all other corporate and private individuals in society. The democratic press is that which is issued by a people's committee comprising all the groups of society. Only in this case, and not otherwise, will the press or any other information medium be democratic, expressing the viewpoints of the whole society and representing all its groups. If medical professionals issue a journal, it must be purely medical. Similarly, this applies to other groups. Private individuals have the right to express only their own and not anyone else's opinions. What is known as the problem of the freedom of the press in the world will be radically and democratically solved. Because it is byproduct of the problem of democracy generally, the problem of freedom of the press cannot be solved independently of that of democracy in society as a whole. Therefore, the only solution to the persistent problem of democracy is through the third universal theory. According to this theory, the democratic system is a cohesive structure whose foundations are firmly laid on basic popular conferences and people's committees, which convene in a general people's congress. This is absolutely the only form of genuine democratic society. In summary, the era of the masses, which follows the age of the republics, excites the feelings and dazzles the eyes. But even though the vision of this era denotes genuine freedom of the masses and their happy emancipation from the bonds of external authoritarian structures, it warns also of the dangers of a period of chaos and demagoguery and the threat of a return to the authority of the individual, the sect and party, instead of the authority of the people. Theoretically, this is genuine democracy, but realistically, the strong always rule, i.e. the stronger party in the society is the one that rules. Part 2, The Solution of the Economic Problem, Socialism. Taboo. Anyway, Chapter 11, The Economic Basis of the Third Universal Theory. Important historical developments contributing to the solution of the problem of work and wages, the relationship between producers and owners, workers and employers, have occurred in recent history. These developments include the determination of fixed working hours, overtime pay, leaves, minimum wages, profit sharing, the participation of workers in administration, the banning of arbitrary dismissal, Social Security, the right to strike, and other provisions contained in labor codes of almost all contemporary legislation. Of no less significance are changes in the realm of ownership, such as the enactment of laws transferring private ownership to the state, and also those limiting income. Despite these not inconsiderable developments in the history of economics, the problem still fundamentally exists, even though it has been made less severe than in past centuries through improvements, refinements, and developments that have brought many benefits to the workers. However, the economic problem still persists unsolved in the world. Attempts aimed at ownership have failed to solve the problems of producers. They are still wage earners despite the state ownership, which may vary from the extreme right to the extreme left to the center of the political spectrum. Attempts to improve wages were equally significant to those that were aimed at the transfer of ownership. In the wake of the Industrial Revolution, benefits from wage negotiations secured for workers certain privileges that were guaranteed by legislation and protected by trade unions, thus improving the lot of the workers. As time passed, workers, technicians, and administrators have acquired certain rights which were previously unattainable. However, in reality, the economic problem still exists. Attempts that were aimed at wages were contrived and reformative and have failed to provide a solution. They were more of a charity than a recognition of the rights of the workers. Why do workers receive wages? Because they carry out a production process for the benefit of others who hire them to produce a certain product. In this case, they do not consume what they produce. Rather, they are compelled to concede their product for wages. Hence, the sound rule, those who produce, consume. Wage earners, however, improve their wages may be, are a type of slave. I repeat. Wage earners, however improved their wages may be, are a type of slave. Wage earners are but slaves to the masters who hire them. They are temporary slaves, and their slavery lasts as long as they work for wages from employers, be they individuals or the state. The worker's relationship to the owner or the productive establishment and to their own interests is similar under all prevailing conditions in the world today, regardless of whether ownership is right or left. Even publicly owned establishments give workers wages as well as other social benefits, similar to the charity endowed by the rich owners of economic establishments upon those who work for them. Now, unlike the privately owned establishment where income benefits the owner, the claim that the income from the public-owned establishment benefits all of the society, including the workers, is true only if we take into consideration the general welfare of the society and not the private well-being of the workers. Further, we would have to assume that the political authority controlling ownership is that of all of the people, practiced through the popular conferences and people's committees, and not the authority of one class, one party, several parties, one sect, tribe, family, individual, or any form of representative authority. Failing this, what is received directly by the workers with respect to their own interests in the form of wages, percentage of profits, or social benefits is the same as that received by workers in a private corporation. In both instances, the producers are wage earners despite the difference in ownership. Thus, this change in ownership has not solved the problem of the producer's right to benefit directly from what he produces, and not through the society nor through wages. The proof thereof is the fact that producers are still wage earners despite the change in this state of ownership. The ultimate solution lies in abolishing the wage system, emancipating people from its bondage, and reverting to the natural laws which defined relationships before the emergence of classes, forms of governments, and man-made laws. These natural laws are the only measures that ought to govern human relationships. These natural rules and laws have produced natural socialism based on equality among the components of economic production, and have maintained public consumption almost equal to natural production among the individuals. The exploitation of man by man and the possession by some individuals of more of the general wealth than their needs required is a manifest departure from the natural rule and the beginning of distortion and corruption in the life of the human community. It heralds the start of the exploitative society. If we analyze the factors of economic production from ancient times to the present, we always find that they essentially consist of certain basic production components, i.e., raw materials, means of production, and in final, a product by a producer. The natural rule of equality requires that each of these components receives a share of this production. Because production cannot be achieved without the essential role of each of these components, it has to be equally divided among them. The preponderance of one of them contravenes the natural rule of equality and becomes an encroachment upon the other's rights. Thus, each must be awarded an equal share, regardless of the number of components in the process of production. If the components are two, each receives half of the production. If three, then one-third of the production. Now, applying this natural rule to both ancient and modern situations, we arrive at the following. At the stage of manual production, the process of production resulted from raw material and producer. Later, new means of production were added to the process. Animals, utilized as power units, constitute a good example. Gradually, machines replaced animals. Types and amounts of raw materials evolved from the simple and inexpensive to the valuable and complex. Likewise, the unskilled workers became skilled workers and engineers, their former huge numbers dwindling to a few specialized technicians. Now, despite the fact that components have qualitatively and quantitatively changed, their essential role in production has remained basically unaltered. For example, iron ore, a component of both past and present production, was manufactured primitively by ironsmiths into knives, axes, spears, and etc. Now, that same iron ore is now manufactured by engineers and technicians by means of smelting furnaces into all kinds of machines, engines, and vehicles. The animal, horse, mule, camel, or the like, which was a component of production, has been replaced by factories and huge machines. Production, based upon primitive tools, is now founded upon sophisticated technical instruments. Despite these tremendous changes, the components of natural production remain basically the same. This consistency inevitably necessitates returning to sound natural rules to solve the economic problems that are the result of all previous historical attempts to formulate solutions that ignore these rules. All previous historical theories tackled the economic problem either from the angle of ownership of any of the components of production or from that of wages for production. They failed to solve the real problem, the problem of production itself. Thus, the most important characteristic of economic order prevailing in the world today is a wage system that deprives the workers of any right to the products being produced, be it for the society or for a private establishment. An industrial establishment is composed of material for production, machines, and workers. Production is achieved by the workers manufacturing materials and using machines. Thus, manufactured goods would not have been ready for use and consumption had they not gone through a production process requiring raw materials, factories, and workers. Clearly, without basic raw materials, the factory cannot operate, and without the factory, raw materials will not be manufactured. Likewise, without producers, the factory comes to a halt. Thus, the three factors are equally essential to the process of production, and without them, there can be no production. The absence of any one of these components cannot be replaced by the others. Therefore, the natural rule necessitates each component receiving an equal share of the benefits of production. It is not only the factory that is important, but those who consume its production as well. The same is applicable to agricultural production processes resulting from only two components, man and land. The product must be divided equally into two shares congruent with the number of production components. Furthermore, if any additional mode, mechanical or otherwise, is utilized in the process, production must be equally divided into three shares, the land, the farmer, and the means of production. Consequently, a socialist system emerges under which all production processes are governed by this natural rule. The producers are the workers. They are called producers because the terms workers, laborer, and toiler have become invalid. The traditional definition is revised because workers are undergoing qualitative and quantitative changes. The working class is declining proportionately to the advancement of science and technology. Tasks once performed by a number of workers are now being carried out by a single machine. Operating a machine requires fewer workers. This has brought about a quantitative change in the labor force, while the replacement of physical force by technical skill has resulted in a qualitative change in the labor force. The labor force has become a component of the production process. As a result of technical advancement, multitudes of unskilled toilers have been transformed into limited numbers of technicians, engineers, and scientists. Consequently, trade unions will subsequently disappear and be replaced by syndicates of engineers and technicians. Scientific advancement is an irreversible gain for humankind. Thanks to this process, illiteracy will be eliminated and unskilled workers will become a temporary phenomenon destined to a gradual disappearance. However, even in this new environment, persons will always remain the basic component in the production process. Chapter 12, Need. The freedom of a human being is lacking if his or her needs are controlled by others. For need may lead to the enslavement of one person by another. Furthermore, exploitation is caused by need. Need is an intrinsic problem and conflict is initiated by the control of one's needs by another. And that was chapters 10, 11, and 12. We finished off part one of the Green Book. We went ahead and started digging into part two of the Green Book. Tune in for the next couple chapters, the next installment of the Green Book, where we go through chapters 13, 14, and 15. 13 covers housing, 14 covers income, and 15 cover means of transportation. Make sure you visit our website, lyricalelitist.com. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/lyricalelitist. You can subscribe to us on YouTube, Lyrical Elitist, as well as TLE TV. And you can donate to help keep pushing what we're trying to do so we can continue to grow and expand at our Patreon at patreon.com/TLE News, or you can go ahead and donate via PayPal. I'm your host, Hassan Labdouni, signing off for the third installment of The Green Book.